Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Before we begin, my notes tell me that we have students from Lake Mills High School, so I assume that's you all looking at me. Please stand if you're here. Oh, that's great. You may be seated. The students have heard a little bit about the case you're going to argue to us because they're participating in a program called Court with Class. If you all can stay after this argument, I'll come down and we'll chat a little bit about how cases get to the Supreme Court and answer some questions and just discuss. We won't talk about the substance of the case that you're about to hear, but there are a lot of other things we can talk about without getting into that. So if you can stay, please do, and I'll come right down when we're done with this argument. It looks as though you are prepared to proceed, Counselor, so I will call our second case of the day, Marks versus Morris. Please begin.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Counsel, for the record, Eric Magnuson, on behalf of the petitioner appellant, Richard Morris. I want to thank the Court for waiting until the fire alarm was done. I thought I could just be getting rolling, only to be overcome by horns. The answers to the two certified questions from the Court of Appeals are no. A member of a Wisconsin LLC does not have standing to assert a claim based on an injury suffered primarily by the LLC. That claim is derivative. It may only be brought in the name of the LLC when authorized by a majority of members.
Counsel, that all sounds very logical, but where does that come from?
That comes from the statute itself, 183.1101.
It speaks of primary and derivativeness?
It speaks of claims on behalf of the corporate or the company only being brought by a member if authorized by a majority of the members. Mr. Boucher, the author who writes the big handbook, as we point out in our reply brief, says that is the legislature's adoption of derivative pleading principles to LLCs. The answer to the second question is yes, the Wisconsin Limited Liability Company law preempts common law claims by a member against another member for self-dealing. The statute allows self-interested transactions if they are approved by a majority of the members, and it also allows the operating agreement to alter the default rule. And in this case, Section 5.8 of the operating agreement does exactly that. It says doing business, a member doing business with the LLC, is not wrongful or improper.
Right, but we still have 183.04.02.1A, which says a willful failure to deal fairly with the limited liability company or its members in connection with a matter in which the member or manager has a material conflict of interest is prohibited, correct?
It does say that,
okay,
Your Honor.
So I understood that to be the claim that was made here under the statute.
Your Honor.
You want to speak to that?
Yes, you've done exactly what my colleague has done in his brief. You've skipped the first part of the statute.
Oh, I?
No, you did.
It says, no member or manager shall fail to act in a manner that constitutes any of the following. Sub A, I read to you. So what part of the statute are we missing here?
The part that says, unless otherwise provided in an operating agreement.
Okay, well, what I'm reading, where do you see that in 183.0402?
Duties of managers and members, period, unless otherwise provided in an operating agreement, colon, sub 1, sub 2.
Okay, but the operating, okay, go ahead. You're telling me that in the operating agreement you get to deal unfairly with members and managers. I guess
no, what,
I don't read the statute quite that broadly.
Well, and I don't mean it to say that.
Okay.
What I mean it to say is that there is no material conflict of interest in a self transaction, in a transaction with the company, because the operating agreement says so.
Okay. But the willful failure to deal fairly can arise even though you can have a conflict of interest and still deal with the members and the LLC.
By definition, it cannot be unfair because it's authorized.
You're saying you read the operating agreement to say that you could never have it be unfair?
Right.
Where does
That's
it
right.
say that in the operating agreement?
Right.
It doesn't say that. What it says is it is not wrongful. It is not.
It's not wrongful to deal personally, but that doesn't mean you wouldn't do so in an unfair way.
Right.
Oh, right. But there's nothing unfair about doing a transaction that is authorized by the operating agreement and by a majority vote
of
the
shareholders. Well, you're not getting into the facts. So you do concede that there are situations that it could be unfair still. The operating agreement doesn't preclude the type of suit. You're getting into the facts now about whether this rises to that level.
Well, what I'm actually doing is I'm trying to answer precisely the question certified to you. And it is unfair conduct with respect to a self-interested transaction. There may certainly be occasions where a majority member of an LLC does something that is unfair to a minority member. You know, we see those kinds of things in corporate derivative direct claims all the time. We're not going to pay dividends to the minority shareholder. We're going to give them to ourselves. That could be unfair.
And that would be actionable under 183.0402, correct?
What is the section of the operating agreement you're relying on? I have it in front of me, and I found nothing that gets around 183.0402, sub 1A.
It's 5.8, Your Honor.
5.8,
and it is at Appendix 125 to 126. It's called Business Opportunities, the General Rule. The general rule is you devote all your time and energy, but nothing in this prevents you from doing business with other entities or having other entities that do business with the LLC. And it says, neither the company, any director, nor any member shall have any right by virtue of this agreement or by the relationship created by this agreement in such other ventures or activities, which is...
Well, what it essentially says is that you can have transactions with the LLC even though you have a conflict of interest.
Right.
But it doesn't say you can deal unfairly with anybody in the course of that.
And it says the pursuit of such ventures shall not be deemed wrongful or improper. So if I do something that is not wrongful, it is not improper, I obey the law, it cannot be unfair.
So in fact, you can write an operating agreement you believe that would let you essentially cheat your partners. That would be okay.
No, Your Honor, that's not what it says. What it says is it's
well, you're reading it so broadly that you're reading totally sub 1A out of the statute. So tell me when you think 1A would be applicable to someone who has a conflict of interest with this operating agreement.
Well, I think in Gottsacker you remanded the case to determine whether what was done in the transaction there, although there was no operating agreement in Gottsacker, which I think is important. It was purely under the statute, whether it was done in a way that was unfair or wrongful. My point is this, Your Honor.
Counsel, perhaps I can just step you through this a little bit. So Section 5.8 of the operating agreement says that the members may engage independently or with others in other business ventures of every nature and description, correct?
Correct.
All right. And they could do that either fairly or unfairly, yeah?
Your Honor, it's not unfair if they do that.
Well, hang on a second. No. So let's just get the groundwork straight here first, and then we'll figure out whether it was unfair or fair, right? So you could engage, the operating agreement allows you to engage independently with others in other business ventures, very nature and description. And that could be done fairly or unfairly.
Sure, you could lie.
Yeah, okay.
And
that would be actionable.
Right,
and that would be actionable under 0402. Yeah? Okay. So, so the operating agreement doesn't exempt the members. I'll give them immunity to do anything they want with respect to other members. They still have to act fairly,
Right, and I think that was one of the points that I was trying to make. By answering the questions certified to you, you make a fairly narrow statement of law, far narrower than Chief Justice, in your concurrence in Gottsacker, that no fiduciary duties apply.
As I look at this case, I look at the lenticular Europe case, which says that if an operating agreement is ambiguous, then the statute controls. So are you telling us, in answer to Justice Kelly's questions and mine, that there's no ambiguity in 5.8 of the operating agreement that's going to let you fall into 183.0402, right?
Not on the claims that are asserted in this case.
And that's because you're saying they're not unfair, right? The activity.
It is not unfair. My client is a 17% owner of the LLC. My client doesn't control a majority. This isn't a case like Gottsacker where the people who had 75% of the power voted a benefit to themselves. He made a proposal to buy an asset of the LLC. It was voted on by a majority of people who had no interest in it at all. You know, I mean, it's my client's 17%. His clients have roughly 25%. The more than 50% of people who didn't have a dog in the fight approved it.
Was it unfair for him to tell Toy, who put up the money, that you're going to lose your money if we don't take the $70,000 a price we're offering for Westar to Northstar? Was that unfair?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Not at all.
He gave his opinion that if you don't do this, we're going to be in big trouble. You have to remember the context of the December 31, 2013 meeting. By Marks and Murray's own testimony, there were discussions about whether they were overextended. If you look at their complaint, paragraph 93, they talk about the fact that the meeting was to talk about the future of Westar. Did they have too much property?
Well, they had the Charcoal Ridge and the pine is the one that was owned by Westar and that you urged them to sell to an LLC in which you and another owner were the members, correct?
My client was a 37% owner, not even a majority owner of that.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, that was, and
when I say you, I mean your client.
Yes, when we get to the fairness, everybody knew that. That was discussed at the meeting. That's not disputed in either the complaint or in the deposition testimony of Marks and Murray. And it's not unfair for one member of a business to say, I think this is a really bad idea to hang on to this property. We're all going to lose our money. We're going to, you know, it's bad. That's not unfair. What would be unfair is if he lied to them, and there's no claim here that he lied to them, or if he used his majority powers to force a deal that the minority didn't want. He didn't do that.
Well, the first time they vote on it, he lost. It was 4-2.
He did.
And then what happened is you had
this. He said, I'm gonna quit.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, and what fiduciary duty does he breach?
Well,
by saying,
you know, I don't need
to
get in the record that far. I think the question presented to us is whether they have a right to make a claim and develop the facts sufficient to fit within 183.0204. It's not that the facts are all here before us. That's not where we are.
I agree with that, Your Honor. Right. Although on certification, you get all of the issues. Part of it is the district court denied summary judgment. My point is that there really are no material facts in dispute on that.
Well, when we take a certification, we take everything.
I appreciate that, which is
right.
Why I'm arguing that summary judgment should have been granted, because that was part of the appeal. My point, I come back to this, Your Honor. If you have an operating agreement, and it's crystal clear law in this state that the operating agreement has primacy over the statute and any common law principles. If you have an operating agreement that says it's okay for one member to do business with the LLC, by definition, it can't be improper or wrong or unfair when he says, here are the facts, I want to do business with the LLC, and a majority of the members say, okay, we approve it. That is, there is nothing that gives
them
a
claim. Well, just let me give you a little hypothetical. What if you'd already had this Pine Creek or Pine Ridge property assessed? This was for frac sand mining. The other piece of property that you bought for not a lot of money, you sold the LLC, sold for $5 million.
What if you had a whisper that this
was going to be sold for $5 million, but instead you told your colleagues, well, you better sell this or we're going to lose our shirts on this. And
those aren't the facts.
I know. What I'm saying to you is we're not dealing with the facts here, and you're saying that summary judgment should be granted. We've not had a record developed on the facts. And if someone wants to argue that it was unfair, what they're asking for is a remand in order to be able to develop the facts. What did your client know when he urged them to sell for $70,000? I mean, we don't know that, and that's not anything we're going to decide here. I think what troubles me is the argument that black and white, you can take an operating agreement and sidestep the fairness that the statute still requires, regardless of whether there's a potential conflict of interest. That's what is troubling me. And they just want to bring it back to show what your clients knew, when they knew it, and maybe there's nothing there. But the facts haven't been developed.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. But now those merits issues are sidestepping the question of whose claim is it. And that's a standing question. And if they don't have standing, they don't have the ability to bring the claim. And if all of those things that you say are true, then
I'm not saying
them.
I'm just saying they want to bring them up.
Let's just assume for purposes of the hypothetical that they are true.
Okay.
It is a claim that belongs to the LLC.
Perhaps.
Eucharist.
Perhaps.
Your Honor, I don't see how it belongs to anything
else. You're talking about the sale of the business for $70,000 being the totality of the claim. That may or may not be the totality of the claim. From their briefs, I understood that your client pushed up his interest in recovery, which had an effect on their individual interests, and just let me finish.
Yes, ma'am.
183.0402 doesn't preclude a claim of unfairness if you've not dealt unfairly with the liability company or its members.
If you read carefully their claim, it is that because my client had a 37% interest in the acquiring entity, his ownership interest in the sold asset went from 17.5, which was his share as a North Star member, mm-hmm. to 37.5 as a DSJ member.
Mm-hmm.
There is no claim that he increased his North Star membership.
I agree.
The question then becomes, if he euchred the company out of a valuable piece of property, for whatever reason, he did it fairly or unfairly, whose claim is that?
Well, this is an LLC, not a corporation.
I
if this were a 180 claim, then I would say it's derivative. But that's not what we have here. We have an LLC.
We do, Your Honor. But the LLC statute, as Mr. Butcher says in his handbook, the legislature adopted what's known as the entity ownership concept. The members do not own the property of the LLC.
I know. The property is personal property, just like an interest is in a corporation. That's what the statute says.
The statute, as Mr. Butcher says, and you pay a lot of attention to him because he wrote the handbook.
Yeah, and his name is Boucher, by the way. I know him.
I was worried about that.
Okay.
I will not make that mistake again. Mr. Boucher says that the entity ownership principle means that the members have no interest in the property of the LLC, which means that when the sale, they don't. They have an interest in the LLC.
They have an interest in the LLC. I agree, and that's all they're complaining about, that their interest in the LLC has been dealt with unfairly by your client.
Correct. Absolutely. We can agree on that. And the result of that is every member is affected the same. every member suffers the same harm, which
no,
is the classic distinction.
He didn't suffer the same harm. He, what they're saying is he is a member of the LLC, and he didn't suffer the same harm as the other members of the LLC. That's what they're saying, whether that's factual or not.
With respect to his membership in the LLC, he did.
Well, if you want to cut it off there, fine, but that's not the argument of counsel. He doesn't think you can cut it off there.
But, Your Honor, under derivative claim principles...
There is not a derivative procedure in 183 as there is a whole procedure in Chapter 180 for derivative actions.
Your Honor, I really hate to find myself disagreeing with you directly so much, but 183...
Make sure you speak up, counsel. Yep.
Maybe 183.1101,
okay,
which Boucher says is the adopted, modified, derivative claim procedure.
Well, he may say that. I'm more interested in what the statute says.
The statute says, unless otherwise provided in an operating agreement, an action on behalf of a limited liability company may be brought in the name of the limited liability company by one or more members, if the members are authorized by to sue by the affirmative vote described in 183.04.04, which is a majority of members.
Can't you just read this, though, as saying this provides the procedure?
Right.
You are bringing a lawsuit in the name of the limited liability company, because
right,
when you continue to read it, it then says, in an action brought on behalf of, it doesn't say anything about whether a member could still bring an action. It doesn't say either way.
To get back to the Chief Justice's point, she said if this were a corporation, because they have a procedure, we would have clearly a derivative claim.
The corporation is very clear, though. They wrote their statute much differently. Wouldn't
right,
you agree?
They did.
I agree. What they did here is they adopted, consistent with the LLC statute's purpose, they adopted a modified, simplified, derivative claim procedure. They don't have the litigation committee, the special litigation committee. The legislature was much more direct and blunt. It said if there's going to be a claim on behalf of the corporation, it has to be approved by a majority.
It doesn't say anything about bringing a claim as a member. And you have to also look at 183.0402(1)(a), which specifically uses language, or its members. So why is that there if you can never bring it on behalf of its members?
Right.
First of all, 104 or 0402 doesn't address direct or derivative claims.
Correct.
183.1101 does.
Okay, and it's silent as to whether a member could bring it themselves if they had harm that was different from that of the...
Right, if they have harm that's different from that of the company, and they don't.
Okay, but
the
now you're getting back to the facts, because the facts really, it's about, we can then apply the law to the facts, but we got to figure out first what the law is. So you are saying that there could possibly be an action under... 183.0402(1)(a) on behalf of the members if they suffered a harm different from that of the limited liability corporation.
Not when it involves self-dealing in the sale of an asset.
Yeah, but the first step of your answer is yes, that is true, right?
Yeah, I think
yes,
so.
Yeah. Okay.
Claims that are asserted
here. Right. But we got to get the groundwork first, right? All right. So now on the question of the derivative versus personal. This is, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think this is what you're saying. 183.1101 says, is the derivative action proceeding by necessity? Because if it was not, if this did not control derivative actions, then every single member could conceivably assert a claim on behalf of the company and have them be contradictory. And you'd have multiple members advancing contradictory claims, allegedly on behalf of the one LLC, correct? That's the problem if this is not a derivative proceeding.
If it's
process.
Not, yes, you've said it better than I could. Thank you very much. If it is not controlling, if it doesn't impose derivative direct claim principles, it has no point in being in the statute. It doesn't say anything then.
I think that it does speak to when you are bringing a claim on behalf of the company. Okay, what is argued here is they have the right to bring an individual claim for individual unfairness to them based on the conduct of your client in the sale of Westar.
Your Honor, with regard to that claim, and I know you keep telling me not to get into the facts, but as pled in the complaint, the argument is that the sale was for inadequate consideration and depleted Northstar's assets. Those are classic, classic derivative claims under corporate law. And if you acknowledge the fact that having a derivative claim procedure in the statute means the legislature intended derivative law principles to apply, then they are out of court on standing, period. End of discussion. Facts don't matter at that point. The law bars their claim. They have no standing.
Before your time is up, can you address your argument that there can be no other common law claims because of the statute? I guess the question more specifically is, are there other cases in which that happened that this court has held that, other than the concurrence in the Godsaker case, are there other situations where we have said that because there is a statute that there is no ability to seek, for example, unjust enrichment, which is an equitable claim?
Your Honor, 183.1302. First of all, short answer to your question, no, there aren't any cases that say that. There's a federal case that says that. That's not binding on you. It's pretty good analysis, but not binding. It's instructive.
In other contexts, you're saying other statutes, there's no precedent for that. I just don't know. I haven't done that research, but I figured that would be something that might be helpful for us to know if that's a path this court has taken.
Ms. Chief Justice, my light is on. May I?
Yeah, you may answer the question.
Thank you. I don't know. but let me just finish that by saying that the legislature made it clear that the operating agreement is primary. It says in 1302 that unless displaced by this statute or the operating agreement, other legal principles apply. The operating agreement says it's not wrongful to do this, and it is, and 1101 provides a derivative pleading or derivative claim procedure, and therefore derivative principles must apply, and they have no standing, and if they have no standing, the lawsuit goes away, and I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think it would be helpful to your argument, though I know you have things prepared, if you would start talking to us about 183.1101 and whether it's a permissive statute to sue on behalf of the LLC or whether it's mandatory.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Patrick Heaney, and I represent the plaintiffs, respondents, Dan Marks, Michael Murray, and their LLCs, Fraxan LLC and R&R Management Funds. As the court has already alluded to, this case has complex, interesting facts, but ultimately straightforward and important legal issues. And the questions certified were, number one, do my clients have standing to pursue their claims against Mr. Morris? And number two, does the Wisconsin limited liability law preempt the common law claims that my clients have asserted against Mr. Morris for self-dealing? The trial court correctly held the answer to that first question is yes, and we believe the answer to the second question is no. I'll jump right into what the Chief Justice suggested. It's important to remember that the first claim that we have asserted is the 183-04-02-1A claim for willful failure to deal fairly with the LLCs or with the LLC or its members. So the question that I think the Chief Justice is asking is, does the subsection of the LLC statutes that talk about who may file suit on behalf of the LLC, does that mandate that a claim under 183-1A be made by the LLC? And we've used the term derivative action, and if you look at a lot of the case law, they always use the term derivative action. But there may be other types of actions that an LLC would file, or maybe even a corporation, besides a traditional derivative action where a shareholder is challenging corporate conduct or saying that there was a wrongdoing. For example, perhaps the LLC has to enforce a contract. Perhaps the LLC has to sue a creditor or a debtor or something like that. So there has to be a mechanism in the statute for those kind of claims to be made, and that's what that part of the statute is dealing with. But in order for that particular part of the statute to override the plain language of 183-04-02-1A that says that a member has a duty to other members, there should be some clear intent in the language for it to do that, and it simply doesn't. So I don't believe the legislature intended for those provisions about who may file a suit on behalf of the LLC to mean that my clients do not have standing to pursue a 183-04-02-1A type claim.
So, counsel, you're not asserting a claim on behalf of the LLC, correct?
That is right.
All right. And 0402 provides that members owe duties to each other, yeah?
Correct.
Okay. Are those the same duties that the members owe to the LLC?
They probably are. I believe that if you look at Godsacker, it talks about the elements of the duty and what the inquiry is. Namely, you got to look at the conduct and you got to look at the end result. I don't think Godsacker fleshes out whether that analysis is different.
Okay.
If it's the LLC or a member, I guess there wouldn't be any good reason why it wouldn't be.
And if the if a member of an LLC suffers harm in the same way that other members of the LLC suffer it, is that a derivative claim or is that a direct claim by the member?
I think 183-04-02-1A makes it a direct claim by the plain language of the statute.
Regardless of the type of injury?
Correct.
So even if the injury is primarily to the LLC, or even exclusively, it's your position that the member can personally assert that cause of action against another member?
That is right, based upon the plain language of the statute.
All right. So then how does that work with 1101? Because 1101 says that if you're going to bring a claim on behalf of the LLC, you got to get an affirmative vote of the membership to do it, right?
Correct.
Okay. And if any member is authorized on its own to bring an action in which the LLC is the injured party, doesn't that present the circumstance where multiple members could bring multiple claims, all seeking redress for the same alleged injury but taking different positions on what that is and legal claims and legal theories and all of that?
Well, I think it goes back to even if there are multiple claims, that's the role of juries. To sort those out and to divvy up the recovery.
Yeah.
There's methods to do that.
I'm not worried about the juries. I'm worried about if you have five members of an LLC, that there are five lawsuits that are seeking the same redress for injury to the LLC, but they're seeking it personally. Why would we countenance such a thing?
Because that's what the way the legislator wrote the statute.
Couldn't 0402 be understood to say that members owe duties to each other, They also owe duties to the LLC. And who gets to pursue those, an injury due to a violation of one of those duties? It's not addressed in 0402. Right? I mean, it says here are duties, right?
Right.
You members of an LLC, you owe duties to each other, and you owe a duty to the LLC. But it doesn't say anything about who gets to bring them.
Well, I would say that the fact that the legislature chose to use the language or its members, if you're going to say that there is a duty, there should be a remedy for that.
Of course.
And so.
Of course. And generally speaking, we say that only the person who suffered the injury gets to bring the claim. Yeah?
Correct.
Okay. So let's say the LLC is the one that suffered the injury. Doesn't that mean that the LLC is the only one that gets to bring the claim?
If you have a circumstance, and I'm trying to think one off the top of my head, where the injury is only to the LLC, then perhaps, but I guess this is part of...
Okay, stop right there. So you say perhaps. What's the perhaps?
Well,
why is that not just yes?
Because this is the issue with LLCs, is the fact that the members are so, I guess, involved and they have a personal interest in the LLC, it's tough...
They have the same personal interest in the LLC that a shareholder has in a corporation.
No, I don't agree.
It's in most in LLCs, the membership interest in the LLC is that member's individual personal property.
Sure. So is a share of a corporation.
And the purpose of LLCs is for direct member participation. It's the purpose of LLCs is so you can have a simple way of creating and doing business and a business entity. So I think part of the problem here is we're taking these corporate principles, this distinction between injury to the LLC or injury to the corporation and injury to the stockholder, and we're trying to shoehorn it into a business entity that is a lot more flexible and it's different, and that you have this direct member participation.
So let's say you're right that any member of an LLC can bring a claim that belongs to the LLC. They can bring it personally, not on behalf of the LLC, but personally. Who does the recovery go to? Does it go to him or does it go to the LLC?
Well, I just want to say that I don't know if a member can bring it on behalf of the LLC for an injury that's specific to the LLC.
Okay. So the first step, then, is to figure out who does the cause of action belong to, right?
Correct.
All right. How do we do that?
Look at the language of 183.04.02.1a.
And what does that tell you about who owns a cause of action when the LLC is the one that suffered the injury?
I don't think that the statute necessarily makes those distinctions between the injury just to the LLC and just to the members because of the nature of the LLC.
Yeah, but I'm trying to figure out a framework within which to consider this. So bear with me. So injury entirely to the LLC, who gets to bring a cause of action for that?
Well, it's hard to make that distinction between entirely to the LLC and entirely to the member.
No, it's not, because I just said the hypothetical is it's entirely to the LLC. So let's assume that.
Okay.
Who gets to bring that action?
Then if it's entirely to the LLC, in your example, Your Honor,
yeah,
then you would have to go through the procedure in 183 that talks about who may bring the action, or in the alternative, look to the operating agreement.
All right, so you're referring to 183.1101, yeah?
Correct.
So if it's so you agree that there are injuries that can only be brought on behalf of the LLC through the procedures specified in 183.1101, yeah?
I agree that there's a mechanism to do that. Where I guess I disagree with is drawing a sharp distinction between delineating an injury specific to the LLC and specific to its members because of the nature of the LLC business entity.
Counsel, one thing that interests me about 183.1101 is it's not mandatory. It says that unless otherwise provided in the operating agreement, and we know counsel has an argument about that, but we'll step aside for that, an action on behalf of a limited liability company may be brought in the name of the limited liability company, and it tells how you go about being able to do that. And I know you started out by saying, well, if there's a breach of contract that the LLC wants to enforce, that's what you would use this provision for. But it doesn't say is required to be brought in the name of the LLC, correct? It says may, which differs considerably from the statute 180, chapter 180, and their mandate on what you can do. Do you think that I'm putting too much emphasis on the may? Is that not helpful to your decision-making? I know Justice Kelly wants to button you up and say there are some claims that can only be brought by the LLC. But if that's the case, why is it discretionary about whether it's brought in the name of the LLC?
I think that's a very important point that you make, is that the legislature did choose to use may, which is not evidence that that is a mandatory procedure.
All right. Let me try to give a more pointed factual scenario. Let's say that the LLC enters into a contract with a supplier. The supplier breaches the contract and damages are owed. Who gets to bring the cause of action?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Damages who?
Damages are owed, right? The supplier has to pay for what it did in breaching the contract. Who gets to bring that cause of action against that third party?
In that case, it would probably make most sense for the LLC to bring the claim.
It might make most sense, but could the member do it instead?
I suppose the member could.
And then if he asserts, if it's his cause of action to assert, does he get the money?
No.
Why not?
But I think it's different than what we have here, because here's why.
No. Hang a sec. I'm trying to figure out the skeleton here, right? So if the member can bring the cause of action for the breach of contract, why doesn't he get the money?
Okay.
It's his cause of action.
I would agree that he would not be able to do it in your hypothetical.
Why not?
Because in that particular case, it's very easy to say that the injury is to the LLC.
Yeah, but I'm looking for a statutory reason why he would not be able to do that.
Because under 183.04.02.1A, we're talking about a member that has a conflict of interest. Your example doesn't have that scenario.
And we do in this case. I know. And 0402 does not talk about a conflict of interest. It just says members, right? And your position is the member can bring the cause of action. So if the member can bring the cause of action for breach of contract with the LLC, why doesn't the member get the money?
I don't think the member would be able to get the money in that case. But 183.04.02.1A says this. It says that there's a duty to deal fairly in which a member or manager has a material conflict of interest. So it's the language in that particular statute that gives standing in our case that may not give standing in your hypothetical. Because in that case, we're not talking about a member that had a material conflict of interest. But in here, we plainly do. That's the difference.
And might it not be a willful failure to deal fairly with the limited liability company if the member asserted that cause of action on his own behalf instead of on behalf of the limited liability company?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I thought in your scenario there was a issue with a supplier.
Yeah. So let's say he goes ahead and does that, and you haven't pointed anything to the statute that says he can't do that. So let's say he does do that, right? Wouldn't that in and of itself be a breach of his duties to his fellow members if he brought that cause of action and then pocketed the damages?
I suppose in that situation, yes.
Right. Isn't that because it's not his cause of action?
I may be unclear on the facts in your example. In your example, are you saying that there is a member of the LLC who has a potential conflict of interest in what he or she did?
Let's save that for the next step, right? This is just a member.
Yeah.
He's asserting a cause of action on behalf of the LLC, and he pockets the proceeds, right?
Yeah.
He can't do that, yeah?
Correct.
Okay. And the reason he can't do that is what? What part of the statute says you can't do that?
Well, I suppose if you have, in your scenario, that a member asserts that action, pockets the proceeds, do I have that right?
Mm-hmm.
Then that potentially would be a material conflict of interest with his or her other members.
Right, because that's not his cause of action, right?
I don't know if it's because it's not his cause of action. It's because of what he did, pocketing the proceeds.
Yeah, but if it's his cause of action, he can pocket the proceeds. That's what, when we talk about cause of action, this is something, when we talk about standing, we're talking about something someone owns. Yeah? So I have standing to bring a cause of action because it's mine. And if it's my cause of action, I get the proceeds if I succeed. Yeah? So if it's wrongful for him to pocket the proceeds of that cause of action, as against his other members, it can only be because it doesn't belong to him.
Or 183.04.02.1a says that he has a material conflict of interest.
And it's a material conflict of interest because cause of action doesn't belong to him, right?
Not necessarily. It could be a material conflict of interest because he asserted the action, his partners were not involved, and he pocketed it and damaged them.
Yes.
I don't necessarily know if you have to say that it's because the claim belonged to the LLC.
Well, if it didn't belong to the LLC and it belonged to him, then there's no reason he couldn't pocket it, right? If it's his cause of action, he gets the compensation. If it's the LLC's cause of action, then the LLC gets the damages. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay.
And
so I think we've gotten to a point, then, that we understand that there's a difference between causes of action that belong to the LLC and causes of action that belong to the members, and the members may not personally benefit from the cause of action that belongs to the LLC. Yeah?
Correct. There might be scenarios like that.
All right. And so any action that that is brought when the injury is to the LLC has to be brought on behalf of the LLC. Yeah?
I don't know if it necessarily does.
Why not?
There may actually be mechanisms, even if the individual member brought it. In your scenario, that individual member pocketed it. But let's say there's a situation where it was held in trust or escrow or something like that where the other members could get it. I mean, you could come up with scenarios where something like that can happen, where it doesn't necessarily end up in the pocket of that particular member.
All right. Well, I think I have monopolized enough of your time for the moment.
Can you talk to me a little bit about 183.03.05 and whether that has any impact on your arguments?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, you said 0305?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what statute is that?
A member of an LLC is not a proper party to a proceeding by or against an LLC solely by reason of being a member of the LLC, except if any of the following exists. One, the object of the proceeding is to enforce a member's right against or liability to the LLC, or two, the action is brought by the member under 1101.
I have not looked closely at that particular statute. I don't think it was briefed by either party. I have to admit that I would have to take a closer look at it. But I don't believe that it affects the issues as they're before the court right now or the way this, that the parties have
briefed it. Doesn't that indicate that sometimes members of LLCs might be parties in proceedings to enforce rights or liability?
It certainly seems like it could be interpreted that way, yes.
I think if you read 183.0305 sub 2, which refers back to 183.1101, you have an interesting connection, which, as usual with statutes, doesn't answer all of the court's questions, but it is an interesting connection.
Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to speak briefly about the operating agreement. It is true that in the LLC statute there is language that says that duties can be modified by the operating agreement. But Section 5.8 of the North Star Sand operating agreement that Mr. Morris admittedly helped to draft, it doesn't have explicit language saying that a member has no duty under 183.04021A. It does not say explicitly that a member can buy an entity that was held by North Star Sand. It doesn't say explicitly that a member may buy or purchase membership units from an entity that was held by North Star Sand. And if you look at I think what the key language is in the operating agreement, it says that a member may engage with persons transacting business with the company. And I think a common sense interpretation of that is that a member may engage in business with maybe a company that does engineering work for North Star Sand or a supplier and go look for frac sand some other place. The other thing I just want to mention, too, about the operating agreement is I know that there's a lot of focus on the meeting that took place and about the transfer of Westar to DSJ. However, Mr. Morris was still a member of North Star Sand with my clients after that transfer. So his duties didn't just disappear. And if you look at Godsacker says you have to look at both the conduct and the end result. So it's also important when we're analyzing this case to understand all that behavior and everything that happened after the transfer as well. And I don't think the operating agreement necessarily goes to that either. So 183.04021A under the clear language allows my clients to pursue these claims. And also, if you look at sub 1, you see 4 enumerated duties. Not only the willful failure to deal fairly, you see improper personal profit, there's something about criminal behavior. And so the legislator chose to use the word any. And a common sense interpretation of that is that those aren't the same things. They all mean different duties. Now, the defendant appellants have referenced subsection 2 of that statute and believe that somehow that negates my client's standing or my client's ability to bring a claim under 1A. And sub 2 of the statute references improper personal profits. And if you look at the language of sub 2, what you see is that it's really just a separate duty or almost a remedy of what a conflicted member must do. That conflicted member must hold the personal profit and account to the LLC for that profit without the consent of a majority of disinterested members. That's it. There's nothing in that subsection that says that there's no standing to bring a claim under 183.04.02.1.1a. It's simply a remedy. And the defendant appellants also believe that there was consent for that profit. And we did allege an improper personal profit along with a willful failure to deal fairly. We plead in the alternative. But sub 2 only talks about consent for an improper personal profit. And there's a lot of factual disputes about whether there was actual consent in this case. And there's also, I think, an inquiry about when the profit actually happened. Did it happen when when Westar was sold for $70,000? Or was the profit much later when it was sold to Uniman for a lot more? And that sale to Uniman and all the profit that Mr. Morris got from that was not. There was no consent for that. None. I want to jump quickly because I see my light is on to the common law because I know it's the second certified question.
Before you do, in page 45 of your brief, you say that the individual injury that your client suffered was that Morris represented any North Star member could participate in DSJ and therefore reap the rewards of any eventual sale of Westar to a major oil and gas company, correct?
Right.
And is that the violation of the 0402?
It's part of it. 0404, subsection 2.
Yeah.
Not necessarily. That, we got to understand when the profit actually happened. If the profit did happen.
Before you get to the profit part, what was the thing that they did that was improper? Is it saying that any North Star member could join in DSJ?
Correct. The individual injury, which we have argued in the alternative, is that Mr. Morris said anybody can join this venture.
Okay.
And when my clients wanted to do that and took him up on that offer, he said no.
Was that an enforceable offer?
I don't know if it's necessary to look at elements of contract law and to make the distinction if it's enforceable. What we need to look at is whether it articulates an individual injury. And the fact that our clients wanted to join and the other folks didn't is enough to articulate an individual injury. It's not dependent.
That articulates a disappointment. I'm not sure it articulates an injury. An injury is a legal concept, right?
Correct.
All right. So what is the legal injury?
The legal suffered? I'm sorry, Your Honor. The legal injury is that their standing in North Star Sand was affected in a different way than the other folks in North Star Sand, like Toy, Johnson, and Glorvin.
Counsel, how about your next issue?
Oh, I'm sorry. Just to touch briefly about common law, if you look at the Limited Liability Company Act, I don't believe there is any clear legislative intent to change the common law and the common law duties that we have asserted in our complaint. And I want to touch briefly on we have also pled an implied duty to deal fairly under the contract, which is a contractual claim and could potentially even be viable if for some reason the operating agreement foreclosed the claims, which we obviously do not agree with. So we just believe that there is no clear legislative intent in the limited liability company law to change the common law on that.
And what's your citation for there has to be clear legislative intent to do that?
That is in my brief, Your Honor. I can get it for you.
No, I know. I know. I just wanted a little more robust of a response, I guess.
Okay. Sorry.
That's okay.
I still got a few more minutes. We do believe that if the court is going to impose either derivative standing or say that our claims are foreclosed under the statute, that should be only applied prospectively for the reasons that were cited in our brief. And we do also have a claim that we asserted against Mr. Morris for duties that he breached. And my time is up.
You can finish the sentence.
and we would just say that whether Mr. Morris breached duties as an attorney is a factual specific inquiry. The ABA says you got to look at whether he's represented people in the past and their expectations, and that's something for the jury. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Those are yours.
Your Honor, I believe that you, Madam Chief Justice, I think you are putting too much emphasis on the word if.
Well, it's may.
May, mm-hmm. Right, because the statute says you may bring the claim if it's authorized by a majority. It doesn't say, oh, you can bring it anyway. It says you have to be authorized by a majority, and that is a limitation, and there is no claim that they were authorized to bring this claim.
Okay, I was kind of looking at it the other way around, that the word may was used because you could bring the claim in another way. Not that may, it was that you didn't have to use that part of the statute. That's what I was concerned about.
And if weren't in the statute, that would be an argument that would make some sense. It would say, well, you may bring it if you want. But it isn't if you want. You may bring it if a majority authorizes it. The only way to read that statute with any fidelity is to say, if they don't authorize it, you can't.
What if any import do you put on 183.0305?
I think it fits like a hand in a glove. It is an expression by the legislature that you have to look at 1101 if you're going to bring a claim that is essentially a claim on behalf of the LLC. That's why it calls it out.
Well, but it talks about members being not being proper parties to proceedings by or against the LLC solely because they're a member, except
if you bring it under 183.1101, which requires a majority to authorize you to do it.
Or if it's to enforce that member's right.
Right.
Well, it's, let's finish up that sentence. If the object of the proceeding is to enforce a member's right against or liability to the limited liability company. So that just speaks to suits between the LLC and a member.
Right. Let me say this. I think it is absolutely clear from Knotts and Rose v. Shantz that if this were a corporation, we wouldn't even be talking about direct or derivative
claim. You're right.
Claim.
You're right.
We have Boucher writing in his handbook that the legislature adopted a modified derivative claim procedure in 1101. If you accept their argument, you're writing it right out of the statute, because the authorization from a majority is no longer necessary. You're treating it as, well, you can bring the claim either if it's authorized or if you just want to. That's not what the legislature said. I will leave with this last point. We've talked about 183.0402 a lot. He's based his claim on 1A, a willful failure to deal fairly, but it's a willful failure to deal fairly by a member who has a material conflict of interest. And my point, and I'm sorry I didn't make it more clear, is that the parties agreed it's not a conflict of interest to have self-dealing with the LLC.
But what do you think sub 3 in that section means?
What do I think sub 3 means?
Doesn't that look like those are the rules that set the floor?
Well, it
that
says
you can have higher standards in an operating agreement.
Right. Mm-hmm. It says that. But it also says at the very beginning, unless otherwise provided in an operating agreement. And that's at the very beginning of 183.0402, and
right.
That modifies.
But sub 3 says an operating agreement may impose duties that are in addition to those.
That's right. And that is consistent with the introduction to 183.0402. Which says, unless otherwise provided in the operating agreement, and I don't think you can read that to say the modification can only be to increase the duties. What Boucher and what this court said in Kasten is the operating agreement gives the parties the right to craft their relationship. And part of this relationship, as they all agreed to when they signed onto the operating agreement, is individual members can do business with the LLC, and it's not wrongful or improper.
If the operating agreement is to control, it must be unambiguous, though, wouldn't you agree?
I don't know what's ambiguous about not wrongful or improper.
That wasn't the question. The question was, if it's to control, it must be unambiguous.
It must be clear, yes.
Okay.
Thank you, members.
Thank you. Thank you both for a really fun argument and really, really interesting case. We don't get a lot of business cases, so thank you very much for bringing it to our attention. The briefs were great. The argument was a lot of fun. I hope you had fun. We certainly did. Right. And it gives us a lot of things to think about, which, of course, we will. We're going to adjourn now until our afternoon argument, which begins at 1:30. And I'm going to come down and chat with you students a little bit. Okay?